This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Eight Mountains, a novel by Paolo Cognetti. Translated by Simon Carnell and Erica Segre. Read by Jacques Roy. Fontane, 2014 through 2016. This story is for the friend who inspired it, guiding me where there is no path, and for the faith and luck that protected it from the start, with all my love. Farewell, farewell, but this I tell to thee, thou wedding guest. He prayeth well who loveth well both man and bird and beast. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Prologue. My father had his own way of going to the mountains, scarcely inclined to meditation, full of obstinacy and arrogance. He would climb headlong, without pacing himself, always competing with someone or something, and where the trail seemed overlong, he would take a shortcut via the steepest slope. When you were with him, it was forbidden to stop, complaining about hunger or the cold was not permitted, but you were allowed to sing a good song, especially when caught in a storm or in thick fog, and to whoop whilst flinging yourself down a snowfield. My mother, who had known him since he was a boy, used to say that even then he would wait for nobody, intent as he was on pursuing anyone glimpsed up ahead. It was only a strong pair of legs that could make you desirable in his eyes, and she hinted, laughing, that this was how she had seduced him. Later on, once the uphill race had begun, she preferred to sit in a meadow, or to soak her feet in a stream, or to identify by name the herbs and flowers. At the summit, she liked more than anything to gaze at the distant peaks, to reflect on those of her youth, and to remember when she had reached them and with whom. Well, my father at that point was overcome by a kind of disappointment and just wanted to return home. I think that these were completely opposite reactions to the same shared sense of nostalgia. My parents had migrated to the city in their early 30s, leaving behind the Veneto countryside where my mother had been born and where my father had been raised as an orphan of the war. Their first mountains, their first love, had been the Dolomites. They would sometimes name them in their conversations, when I was still too young to follow what they were saying, but could sense how certain words rang out, special sounds that were charged with additional meaning. The Catanacho, Sassolungo, Tofane, and the Marmolata. All it took was for my father to utter one of these words, and my mother's eyes would light up. These were the places where they had fallen in love, as even I came to understand after a while. It had been a priest who had taken them there as adolescents, and it was the very same priest who had married them one autumn morning in front of the little chapel found at the foot of the Tre Cime de Lavaredo. This marriage in the mountains was the foundational myth of our family, boycotted by my mother's parents for reasons unknown to me. Celebrated with a handful of friends in anoraks instead of wedding attire, and with a bed in the Oronzo refuge for their first night as husband and wife. The snow was already sparkling on the ledges of Cima Grande. It was a Saturday in October in 1972, the end of the climbing season for that year and for many years to come. The next day they packed their leather climbing boots and plus fours into the car, together with her pregnancy and the contract for his new job, and headed for Milan. Calmness was not a virtue my father set much store by, but in the city it was more necessary than the lungs needed for climbing. In the 70s in Milan, we lived in an apartment building with a panoramic view, above a broad avenue of traffic beneath the asphalt of which, it was said, the Alona River ran. And although it is true that on rainy days the road would become flooded, and I would imagine the subterranean river roaring beneath it in the dark, so swollen as to burst from the drains, it was the other river coursing with cars, vans, scooters, lorries, buses, and ambulances, which seemed always to be in full spate. We lived high up, on the 7th floor, and the two ranks of identical buildings that lined the road amplified the noise. Some nights, my father could stand it no longer. He would get out of bed and fling open the window as if he wanted to inveigh against the city, to compel it to be quiet, to douse it with boiling pitch. He would stand there for a moment, looking down, then slip on his coat and go out to walk around. Through those window panes, we could see a lot of sky. uniformly white, oblivious to the changing seasons, marked only by the flight of birds. My mother obstinately persisted in cultivating flowers on the small balcony that was blackened by exhaust fumes and mold-stained by the rain. On that balcony, whilst tending her fragile plants, she would tell me about vineyards in August, about the countryside in which she had grown up, about the tobacco leaves hung from the racks in the drying kiln, or about the asparagus that, if it were to remain tender and white, had to be cut before it pierced the soil's surface, requiring a rare talent to spot it while still underground. Now that sharp eye of hers had become useful in a radically different context. In the Veneto, she had been a nurse, but once in Milan, she secured a position as a health worker in the Elms district in the western outskirts of the city, in a working-class neighborhood. It was a role that had just been created, together with the equally new family clinic in which she worked, providing support for women during pregnancy, and following the development of the newborn infants in their first year of life. This was my mother's work, and she liked it. The only thing was that the area where she had been sent to carry it out made it seem more like a mission. Actual elms in these parts were few and far between. The entire toponymy of the neighborhood, with its streets named after alders, spruce, larches, and birch trees, contrasted mockingly with the 12-story barrack-like housing blocks infested with social ills of every kind. Among my mother's duties was the evaluation of the conditions in which a child was being raised, on visits that affected her deeply for days afterwards. In the most serious cases, she was obliged to refer children to the juvenile court. It cost her a great deal of anguish to reach such a point, in addition to receiving a dose of insults and threats. And yet despite this, she never doubted that she had reached the right decision. She was not alone in this conviction. The social workers, the educationalists, the school teachers were united by a deep-seated solidarity, a feminine sense of collective responsibility towards these children. My father, on the other hand, had always been a loner. He worked as a chemist in a factory, with a 10,000-strong workforce constantly subject to strike action and sackings. And whatever had taken place in there, he would return home in the evening full of anger. At supper time, he would stare in silence at the TV news, gripping his cutlery in midair as if he expected at any moment the outbreak of another world war. And he would curse to himself at the news of every murder victim, every governmental crisis, every hike in the price of oil, every bombing by unidentified terrorists. With the few colleagues he would invite home, he discussed almost exclusively political issues, and always ended up in an argument. He would cast himself as anti-communist with communists, as a radical with Catholics, as a free thinker with anyone who presumed to confine him in a church or on a list of party members. But these were not times during which you could escape all allegiance, and after a while my father's workmates stopped coming round. Yet he continued to go to work as if he were climbing every morning into the trenches. He continued not to sleep at night, to take things too much to heart, to wear earplugs and take pills for his headaches, to explode in violent fits of rage. At which point my mother would spring into action, since along with her marital duties she had also assumed the role of pacifying him, of muffling the blows in the fight between my father and the world. At home, they still spoke the dialect of the Veneto. To my ears, it sounded like a secret language that they shared, the echo of a mysterious previous life. A remnant of the past, just like the three photographs my mother had displayed on a small table in the entrance hall. I would often stop to look at them. The first was a portrait of her parents in Venice during the only trip they had ever taken, a gift from my grandfather to my grandmother to celebrate their silver wedding anniversary. In the second, her entire family had posed for the camera during the grape harvest. My grandparents sat at the center of the group, three girls and a young man standing around them, the baskets filled with grapes in the courtyard of the barn. In the third, my grandparents' only male offspring, my uncle, smiled together with my father next to a summit cross, dressed in mountaineering gear with a rope wound round his shoulder. My uncle had died young, and that was why I bore his name, though I was called Pietro and he was Piero in our family lexicon. And yet, of all these people, I had known none. I was never taken to visit them, nor did they ever turn up for a visit in Milan. A few times a year, my mother would take a train of a Saturday morning and come back Sunday evening a little sadder than she'd left. Then she would get over it and life would continue. There was too much to be done and too many people to care for to indulge in melancholy. But that past had a way of leaping out at you when you least expected it. Long car journeys were necessary to take me to school, my mother to the clinic, and my father to the factory. And on certain mornings she would sing an old song. She would begin the first verse in traffic, and soon after we would join in. These songs were set in the mountains during the Great War. The troop train, the Sugana Valley, the captain's testament. They told stories that I, too, now knew by heart. 27 had departed for the front, and only 5 had returned. Down there on the battlefield of the Piave stood a cross for a mother who would sooner or later come in search of it. Far away, a betrothed waited, sighing, then tired of waiting and married another. The dying man would send her a kiss and ask for a flower in return. I understood from the words of dialect in these songs that my parents had carried them from their previous life, but I also sensed something different and strange. That is to say that these songs also spoke directly about the two of them, who knows how. I mean about the two of them specifically. How else to explain the degree of emotion that their voices so clearly betrayed? Then, on certain rare windy days in autumn or spring, at the end of Milanese streets, the mountains would appear. It would happen after a bend in the road, above an overpass, suddenly, and the gaze of both my parents would immediately switch there, without one needing to point out anything to the other. The peaks were white, the sky a rare blue, the sensation as of a miracle. Down below, where we lived, were factories in turmoil, overcrowded social housing, riots in the piazza, abused children, teenage mothers. Up there, the snow. My mother would ask then which mountains were in view, and my father would look around as if navigating the urban geography with a compass. Which avenue is this? Monza? Zara? Then it must be La Grigna, he would say, having thought about it a bit. Yes, I'm sure that it is really her. I remembered the story well. La Grigna was a most beautiful and cruel warrior who had killed with her arrows the knights who climbed to declare their love for her. So God had punished her by turning her into a mountain. And now she was there, through the windscreen, allowing herself to be admired by the three of us, each one with a different, silent thought. Then the lights changed, a pedestrian would run across, someone sounded the horn. My father would tell them where to get off and change gear furiously, accelerating away from that moment of grace. The end of the 70s arrived, and while Milan was burning, the two of them put on their climbing boots again. They did not head east from where they had come, but west, as if continuing their flight, towards the Ossola, the Valsesia, the Val d'Aosta, towards mountains that were still higher and more severe. My mother would later tell me that at first she had been overcome by an unexpected feeling of oppression. Compared to the gentle contours of the Veneto and the Trentino, these western valleys seemed narrow, dark, enclosed like gorges. The rock was damp and black, streams and waterfalls plunging down from everywhere. So much water, she thought. It must rain a lot here. She had not realized that all of that water originated in an exceptional source, nor that she and my father were heading straight for it. They climbed up one of the valleys until they were high enough to emerge again into sunlight. From there, the landscape suddenly opened up, and before their eyes stood Monte Rosa, an Arctic world, a permanent winter, looming over the summer pastures. It frightened my mother, but my father would say that for him it had been like discovering a new scale of grandeur, like arriving from the mountains of men to find yourself in the mountains of giants. And naturally, he fell in love with them at first sight. I don't know exactly where they were on that day, whether it was Macugnaga, Alagna, Gressone, Ayas. At that time, we would holiday in a different place each year, following my father on his restless wandering all around the mountain that had conquered him. Better than the valleys, I remember the houses in which we stayed, if you could call them houses. We would rent a bungalow in a campsite or a room in a hostel and stay there for a couple of weeks. There was never enough room to make these places homely or time enough to become attached to anything, but my father did not care for or even notice such things. As soon as we arrived, he would get changed, take from his bag the checked shirt, the corduroy trousers, the woolen jumper, and wearing these old clothes again, he became a different man. He would spend the short vacation exploring the mountain paths, leaving early in the morning and returning in the evening or even the next day, covered in dust, burnt by the sun, tired and happy. Over supper, he would talk of the chamois and the alpine ibexes, of nights spent bivouacked, of starlit skies, of snow that at such altitudes fell even in August. And when he was most happy, he would end by saying, "I really wish that you could have been there with me." The fact of the matter is that my mother refused to climb the glacier. She harbored an irrational and unshakable fear of it. She used to say that, as far as she was concerned, the mountain ended at 3,000 meters, the altitude, that is, of her own range, the Dolomites. She preferred 2,000 meters to 3, the meadows, rivers, woods, and deeply loved 1,000 to 2, the life there of those villages of wood and stone. When my father was away, she liked to go for walks with me, to drink a coffee in the square, to sit in a meadow and read to me from a book, to exchange a few words with a passerby. She reluctantly endured our constant changes of place. She often pleaded with my father that she would prefer a house that she could make her own, and a village to return to, and he would tell her that there wasn't enough money for another rent in addition to that of the apartment in Milan. But she managed to negotiate with him a budget that was within their means, and finally he allowed her to begin searching for a place of our own. In the evenings, as soon as the remains of supper had been cleared away, my father would unfold a map onto the table and begin planning the next day's route. He had beside him the gray booklet of the Italian Alpine Club and a half-filled glass of grappa that he would occasionally sip from. My mother would take advantage of her own moment of freedom by sitting in an armchair on the bed and immersing herself in a novel. For an hour or two, she would disappear into its pages, as if she were elsewhere. It was then that I would climb onto my father's lap to see what he was up to. I would find him to be cheerful and talkative, the complete opposite of the father I was used to in the city. He was happy to show me the map and how to read it. "This is a glacial stream," he would point out to me. "This is a lake, and this is a group of mountain huts. Here you can distinguish the forest by its color, the alpine meadow, the scree, the glacier. These curved lines indicate the altitude. The closer together they are, the steeper the mountain, up to the point where it is impossible to climb further. And here, where the lines are further apart, the incline is gentler and the paths follow it. Can you see?" These triangles, accompanied by a figure for the altitude, represent the summits. And it's to the summits that we're going. We only start descending when it's impossible to climb higher. Understand? No, I could not understand. I needed to see it, this world that filled him with such joy. Years later, when we started to go there together, my father claimed to recall the precise moment at which my vocation manifested itself. One morning, as my mother still slept and he was preparing to leave, he looked up from lacing his boots to see me standing there, already fully dressed and ready to follow him. I must have dressed myself whilst still in bed. I had startled him in the darkness, looking much older than my 6 or 7 years. According to his version of the event, I was already what I would become later. It was a premonition of his adult son, a ghost of the future. "Don't you want to sleep a little longer?" he asked, speaking softly so as not to wake my mother. "I want to come with you," I'd replied, or so he would claim. But perhaps it was just the phrase that he liked to remember. 1. The Mountain of Childhood. 1. The village of Grana was located on the periphery of one of those valleys ignored as irrelevant by those who passed by it, sealed in as it was by the iron-gray peaks above and by a cliff that obstructed access from below. On the top of the cliff, the ruins of a tower still looked out across overgrown fields. A dirt track deviated from the regional trunk road and climbed steeply in circles up to the foot of the tower. Then, getting less steep beyond it, the track turned up the flank of the mountain and entered the great valley at its midpoint before continuing on a slight slope. It was in July of 1984 that we first took it. They were scything hay in the fields. The valley proved to be more extensive than it appeared from below, covered by forest on the side that was in shadow and terraced on the side that was in sunlight. Down below, amongst the thickets of bushes, ran a river that I glimpsed intermittently, sparkling. And this was the first thing about Grana that appealed to me. I was reading adventure stories at the time, and it was Mark Twain who had induced in me a love of rivers. I thought that down there you could fish, dive, swim, cut down some small tree, and build a raft, and absorbed in such fantasies, I hardly noticed the village that had come into view after a curve in the road. "This is it," my mother said. "Go slowly." My father slowed to a walking pace. Since starting out, he had followed her directions obediently. He lowered his head, looking right and left through the dust raised by the car, his gaze dwelling on the stables, the chicken coops, the log-built haylofts, the charred or collapsed dwellings, the tractors at the edge of the road, the hay balers. Two black dogs wearing bells around their necks sprang out from a courtyard. Apart from a couple of newer houses, the whole village seemed to be made of the same gray rock as the mountain, and clung to it like an outcrop or an ancient landslide. A little further up, goats were grazing. My father said nothing. My mother, who had discovered this place on her own, pointed out where to park and got out of the car to look for the owner while we unloaded the luggage. One of the dogs came toward us, barking, and my father did something I'd never seen him do before. He stretched out a hand for it to sniff, spoke to it gently, and stroked it between its ears. Perhaps he got on better with dogs than with his own kind. "And so?" he asked me, as we unhooked the elastics from the roof rack. "What do you think of it?" "It's beautiful," I would like to have answered. A smell of hay, stable, wood, smoke, and who knows what else had enveloped me as soon as I'd stepped out of the car, full of promise. But unsure as to whether this was the right answer or not, I had replied instead, "It's not bad. What do you think?" My father shrugged his shoulders. He looked up over the suitcases and glanced at the shack that stood before us. It was leaning to one side and would surely have collapsed if it weren't for the two poles that were propping it up. Inside it was crammed with bales of hay, and above the hay there was a denim shirt that someone had taken off there and forgotten. "I grew up in a place like this," he said, without letting me know whether this was a good or a bad thing. He grabbed the handle of the suitcase and was about to take it down when something else occurred to him. He looked at me, thinking of something that evidently caused him great amusement. "In your opinion, can the past happen again?" "It's difficult," I said, so as not to be wrong-footed. He was always asking me riddles of this kind. He saw in me an intelligence similar to his own, inclined towards logic and mathematics, and thought that it was his duty to exercise it. "Look at that river," he said. "Can you see it? Let's suppose that the water is time passing. If where we are now is the present, where do you think the future is located?" I thought about it for a moment. It seemed like an easy one. I gave the most obvious answer. "The future is where the water goes, down over there." "Wrong," my father declared. "Fortunately." Then, as if he had freed himself from a great burden, he said, "Whoopala," the word he used to use when picking something up, including me, and the first of the two suitcases fell to the ground with a thud. The house my mother had rented was in the upper part of the village, in a courtyard set around a drinking trough. It bore the signs of two distinct periods. The first was that of its walls, balconies of blackened larch, a roof of moss-covered slates, the large soot-stained chimney, all pointing to its venerable origins. The second was merely dated, a period in which, inside the house, layers of linoleum had been used to cover the floor, floral wallpaper had been hung, fitted cabinets, and the basin had been installed in the kitchen, all now damp-stained and faded. The only object that could be salvaged from this mediocrity was a black stove made of cast iron, massive and severe, with a brass handle and four hot plates on which to cook. It must have been reclaimed from another place and time altogether. I think that what my mother liked more than anything else was what was not actually there, because she had found in effect a house that was more or less empty. She asked the proprietress if we could improve it a bit, and she had simply replied, "Do what you like." She had not rented it out for years, and in all likelihood had not expected to do so that summer. She was brusque in her manner, but not impolite. I think she was embarrassed, since she had come from working in the fields and had not had time to change. She handed my mother a large iron key, finished saying something about the hot water, and gave a brief show of resistance before accepting the envelope that my mother had prepared. By this time my father had made himself scarce. For him, one house was much like another, and the next day he was expected back in the office. He had gone out onto the balcony for a smoke, his hands on the coarse wood of the balustrade, his eyes scrutinizing the summits. It looked as if he were surveying them in order to calculate from which angle to launch an assault. He came back in after the owner of the house had left, so as to be spared any pleasantries, in a somber mood that had come upon him in the meantime. He said that he was going out to get something for lunch, and that he wanted to be back in the car before the evening. In that house, once my father had gone, my mother reverted to a version of herself that I had never known before. In the morning, as soon as she had got out of bed, she would put some kindling in the stove, scrunch up a page of newspaper, and strike a match on the rough surface of the cast iron. She wasn't bothered by the smoke that would then unfurl into the kitchen, or by the need to wrap ourselves in a blanket until the room warmed up, or by the milk that she would overheat and burn on the scalding hot plate. For breakfast, she would give me toast and jam. She would wash me under the tap, scrubbing my face, neck, and ears before drying me with a kitchen rag and sending me on my way outdoors, out into the wind and the rain, so that I would finally lose a little of my delicate urban constitution. On those days, I would set about exploring the river. There were two boundaries that I was not allowed to cross. Upstream, a small wooden bridge beyond which the banks steepened increasingly and narrowed into a gully. Downstream, the thickets at the foot of the cliff where the water followed its course to the valley floor. This was the territory that my mother could control from the balcony of the house. But for me, it was as good as having the whole river itself. That river coursed down crags at first, falling in a series of foaming rapids between huge rocks which I peered over to observe the silver reflections at the bottom. Further on it slowed and meandered as if transformed from youth to adulthood, and cut around islets colonized by birch trees that I could leap across to reach the opposite bank. Further on still, a tangle of timber formed a barrier. At this point a gorge descended, and it had been an avalanche during winter that had torn down the trunks and branches that were now rotting in the water, though at the time I knew nothing of such things. In my eyes, it was the moment in the life of the river when it simply encountered an obstacle, then stopped and stagnated. I would always end up sitting there, watching the weed that was undulating just below the surface of the water. There was a young boy who grazed cows in the meadows along the banks of the river. According to my mother, he was the nephew of the woman who owned the house. He always carried with him a yellow stick made of plastic and with a curved handle, with which he would prod the cows toward the tall grass. There were seven of them, all chestnut-colored and restless. The boy would scold them when they wandered off by themselves and would occasionally chase after one or another of them, cursing. While on the way back, he would climb the slope and turn to call out to them with an "oh-oh-oh" or an "eh-eh-eh," until reluctantly they would follow him to the stable. In the pasture, he would sit down and watch them from above, carving a small piece of wood with his penknife. "You can't stay there," he said, the one time that he spoke to me. "Why not?" I asked. "You're trampling the grass." "So where can I stay?" "Over there." He pointed to the other side of the river. I could not see how to reach it from where I was standing, but I did not want to ask him or to negotiate a passage through his grass. So I stepped into the water without taking off my shoes. I tried to keep upright in the current and to show no hesitation, as if fording rivers was an everyday occurrence for me. I managed to cross, sat down with my trousers soaked and my shoes streaming, but when I turned to look at the boy, he was no longer paying any attention to me. We spent a good few days in this way, on opposite banks of the river, not deigning to notice each other. "Why don't you try to make friends with him?" my mother asked one evening in front of the stove. The house was impregnated with the damp of too many winters, so we would light the fire during supper and stay up warming ourselves until it was time for bed. We would both be reading our books, and every so often, between one page and another, the fire and our conversation were rekindled. The great black stove was listening to us. "But how can I?" I answered. "I don't know what to say." "You just say hello. Ask him what he's called. Ask him what his cows are called." "Okay, good night," I said, pretending to be absorbed in my reading. When it came to social interaction, my mother was well ahead of me. Since there were no shops in the village, while I was exploring my river, she discovered the stable where you could buy milk and cheese, the allotment that sold certain types of vegetables, and the sawmill for a supply of offcuts of wood. She had also come to an arrangement with the young man from the dairy, who every morning and evening passed by in his van to collect the milk churns, so that he would deliver us bread and a few groceries. And I'm not sure how she did it, but by our second week she had hung flower baskets on the balcony and filled them with geraniums. Now our house could be recognized from a distance, and she was already hearing the sparse inhabitants of Grana greeting her by her name. "Anyway, it doesn't matter," I said a minute later. "What doesn't matter?" "Making friends. I also like to be on my own." "Oh, really?" my mother said. She raised her eyes from the page, and without smiling, as if it was a very serious matter, she added, "Are you sure about that?" And with that, she decided to help me herself. Not everyone is of the same opinion, but my mother was firmly convinced of the necessity to intervene in the lives of others. A couple of days later, in that same kitchen, I found the cowboy sitting on my own chair having breakfast. I smelt him, in fact, before seeing him, because he exuded the same smell of the stable, of hay, curdled milk, damp earth, and wood smoke, which has always been for me, from that moment onwards, the smell of the mountains, the smell that I have found in all mountains anywhere in the world. His name was Bruno Guglielmina. Everyone in Grana had the same surname, he insisted on explaining, but the name Bruno was unique to him. He was just a few months older than me, born in November of 72. He devoured the biscuits that my mother offered him as if he'd never eaten biscuits in his life before. The final discovery I made was that it wasn't just me studying him down in the pasture while both of us pretended to be oblivious to each other. He had been studying me, too.
"You like the river, don't you?"
he asked.
"Yes."
"Can you swim?"
"A bit."
"Fish?"
"Not really."
"Come on, I'll show you something." Saying this, he jumped from the chair. I exchanged looks with my mother, then ran after him without a second thought. Bruno took me to a place that I already knew, where the river passes through the shadow cast by the little wooden bridge. Speaking low when we had reached the riverbank, he ordered me to remain as quiet and hidden as possible. Then he gradually raised himself above the rock he was crouching behind until he was just able to peer over it. He signaled with his hand for me to wait. While I waited, I looked at him. He had straw-blonde hair, and his neck was burnt by the sun. He wore trousers in a size not his own, rolled up at the ankles and low-slung, a caricature of a grown man. He also had the demeanor of an adult, a kind of seriousness in his voice and gestures. With a nod, he commanded me to join him, and I obeyed. I peered over the rock to see what he was looking at. I did not know what I was supposed to see there. Beyond the rock, the river formed a small waterfall and a shadowy pool, probably knee-deep. The surface of the water was unsettled, agitated by the churning fall. At the edges floated a finger's depth of foam, and a large, trapped branch sticking out diagonally had collected grass and sodden leaves around itself. It wasn't much of a spectacle, only water that had run there from the mountain, and yet it was spellbinding. I don't know why. After staring hard at the pool for a while, I saw the surface break slightly and realized that there was something moving beneath it. One, two, three, and then four tapering shadows with their snouts facing into the current, with only their tails moving slowly from side to side. Occasionally, one of the shadows would shift suddenly before stopping in another place. At other times, it would break the surface with its back before sinking below again, but always stayed pointing in the direction of the little waterfall. We were further down the valley than they were, which was why they had not noticed us yet.
"Are they trout?"
I whispered.
"Fish,"
said Bruno.
"Do they always stay here?"
"Not always. Sometimes they change hole."
"But what are they doing?"
"Hunting,"
he replied, as if to him it was the most obvious thing. I, on the other hand, was learning about it for the first time. I had always thought that fish swam with the current, which seemed easiest, and not that they would use up their energy by going against it. The trout moved their tails just enough to remain stationary. I would like to have known what they were hunting. Perhaps it was the gnats that I could see skimming the surface before stopping, as if trapped by it. I observed the scene carefully for a while, trying to understand it better, before Bruno suddenly lost interest and leapt to his feet, waving his arms so that the trout sped away in an instant. I went to have a look. They had fled from the center of the pool in every direction. I looked into the pool, and all that I could see was the white and blue gravel at the bottom. And then I had to abandon it to follow Bruno as he rushed up the opposite bank of the river. A little further on, a solitary building loomed above the bank like the house of a watchman. It was falling to ruin amongst the nettles, the brambles, the wasps' nests desiccating in the sun. In this countryside, there were so many ruins just like this one. Bruno placed his hands on the walls at a point where they met in a corner that was all cracks, pulled himself up, and with two quick movements reached the first floor window. "Come on," he said, peering out from above. But then neglected to wait for me. Perhaps to him there seemed no difficulty in my following, and it did not occur to him that I might need help. Or perhaps he was just accustomed to this, that whether easy or difficult, it was every man for himself. I copied him as best I could. I scraped my arms on the sill of the small window, looked inside, and saw Bruno lowering himself through the trapdoor of the attic on a ladder that led to the lower room. I think I had already decided that I would follow him anywhere. Down below, in the semi-darkness, there was a space subdivided by low walls into four rooms of equal size, resembling tanks. In the air hung a stagnant smell of mold and rotten wood. As my eyes gradually adjusted to the dark, I saw that the floor was littered with cans, bottles, old newspapers, shirts and rags, four wrecked shoes, bits of rusty equipment. Bruno had bent down next to a large white polished stone in the shape of a wheel that was placed in a corner of one room. "What is it?" I asked. "The grindstone," he said, then added, "the stone of the mill." I bent down next to him to look. I knew what a grindstone was, but had never seen one with my own eyes before. I stretched out my hand. The stone was cold, slimy, and in the hole at its center, moss that adhered to your fingertips like green mud had gathered. I felt my arms smarting with the scratches from the window ledge. "We need to stand it up," Bruno said.
"Why?"
"So that it can roll."
"But where to?"
"What do you mean, where to? Down, no?" I shook my head because I did not understand. Bruno explained patiently. "We stand it upright, we push it outside, and then we roll it down into the river. Then the fish will leap out of the river, and we can eat them."
The idea seemed both awesome and impossible. That boulder-like weight was too much for us, but it was so lovely to imagine it rolling down and to imagine that the two of us were capable of such a feat that I decided to offer no objection. Someone must have already tried to move it, since between the stone and the floor two woodcutter's wedges had been inserted. They had gone under it just enough to raise it from the ground. Bruno picked up a stout stick, the handle of a pickaxe or a spade, and with a stone began to hammer it into that gap like a nail. When the end of it had wedged in, he worked the handle beneath the stone and stopped it with his foot.
"Now help me," he said.
"What should I do?" I moved next to him. We were supposed to both push downwards, using the combined weight of our bodies to raise the millstone. So we clung together on the handle, and when my feet left the ground, I felt, for a moment, that the great stone moved. Bruno had devised the right method, and with a better lever it might have worked, but that piece of old wood bent under our weight, creaking before eventually snapping in two and flinging us to the ground. One of his hands was injured. He let out a resounding curse.
"Have you hurt yourself?" I asked.
"Shitty stone," he said, sucking his wound. "Sooner or later, I'll move you from there." He climbed up the stepladder and disappeared above, moving furiously, and moments later I heard him jump down from the window and run away. That evening, I struggled to get to sleep. It was excitement that kept me awake. Mine was a solitary childhood, and I wasn't used to doing things with others. In this respect, too, I believed I was just like my father. But that day I had felt something, an unexpected sense of intimacy that both attracted and frightened me, like an opening into unknown territory. To calm myself, I sought for a mental image. I thought of the river, of the pool, of the small waterfall, of the trout that moved their tails to remain stationary, of the leaves and twigs that flowed elsewhere, and then of the trout darting to meet their prey. I began to understand a fact, namely that all things for a river fish come from upstream, insects, branches, leaves, everything. That's why it looks upstream, waiting for things to come. If the point at which you immerse yourself in the river is the present, I thought, then the past is the water that has flowed past you, that which has gone downstream and where there is nothing left for you, whereas the future is the water that comes down from above, bringing dangers and surprises. The past is in the valley, the future in the mountains. This is how I should have replied to my father. Whatever destiny may be, it resides in the mountains that tower over us. Then gradually these thoughts also disappeared, and I lay awake, listening. I was used by now to the sounds of the night, and could recognize them from one another. This, I thought, is the water flowing into the drinking trough. This is the bell on the collar of a dog on its nocturnal wanderings. This is the buzzing of Grana's solitary electric street lamp. I wondered whether Bruno, in his own bed, would be listening to the same sounds. My mother turned a page in the kitchen, while the crackle of the stove lulled me to sleep. For the rest of that July, not a day passed without us meeting up. Either I joined him in the pasture, or Bruno strung a wire around his cows, connected it to a car battery, and turned up in our kitchen. More than the biscuits, I think that it was my mother that he liked. He liked the attention she paid to him. She would question him openly, without preliminaries, as she was used to doing in her work, and he would answer, proud of the fact that his own story could be of interest to such a nice lady from the city. He told us that he was the youngest inhabitant of Grana, as well as the last boy left in the village, given that there was no prospect of any others. His father was away for the best part of the year, would turn up rarely and only in winter, and as soon as he sensed the arrival of spring in the air, he would set off again for France or Switzerland, or wherever he could find a building site in need of workers. By contrast, his mother had never moved from the village. In the fields above the houses, she had a vegetable garden, a hen house, two goats, beehives. Her sole interest was in watching over this little kingdom. When he described her, I recognized immediately who she was. A woman I had frequently seen passing me by, pushing a wheelbarrow or carrying a hoe and a rake. She would overtake me with her head down, seemingly oblivious to my existence. She lived with Bruno at an uncle's house. He was the husband of our landlady and the owner of some pastures and dairy cows. This uncle was in the mountains with his older cousins. Bruno gestured towards the window through which at that moment I could only see woods and scree, and added that he would join them up there in August with the younger cows that had been left down below. "In the mountains?" I asked. "I mean in the mountain pastures. Do you know what an arpeggio is?" I shook my head. "And are your uncle and aunt nice to you?" my mother interrupted. "Of course," said Bruno. "They have a lot to do."
"You go to school, though?"
"Oh, sure."
"Do you like it?"
Bruno shrugged. He couldn't bring himself to say yes, even just to please her.
"And do your mother and father love each other?"
At this, he looked away. He curled his lip into a grimace, which might have meant no, or perhaps just a little, or that this was not a subject to stay there chatting about. The reply was enough to stop my mother from insisting further, since she had understood that there was something about the conversation that he did not like. She would never have let it drop otherwise. When Bruno and I were alone together, we never discussed our families. We wandered around the village, but never strayed too far from his grazing cows. To have adventures, we explored abandoned buildings. In Grana, there were more of these than even we could have wished for. Old stables, old haylofts and granaries, an old shop with its dust-covered empty shelves, an ancient bread oven blackened by smoke.
Everywhere there was the same kind of detritus that I had seen at the mill, as if for a good while after these buildings had fallen into disuse, someone had been occupying them badly, until they were abandoned for good. In some kitchens we would find a table and a bench still in place, a plate or one or two glasses in the larder, a frying pan still hanging above the fireplace. 14 people were living in Grana in 1984, but in the past there had been as many as 100. The village was dominated by a building that was more modern and imposing than the houses that surrounded it. It had 3 white plastered floors, an external staircase, and a courtyard enclosed by a wall that had collapsed at one point. We got in through there, stepping over the weeds that had invaded the courtyard. The door on the ground floor had only been pulled to, and when Bruno pushed it, we found ourselves in a shadowy entrance hall, complete with benches and a wooden coat rack. I realized immediately where we were, perhaps because all schools resemble one another. But the school in Grana was being used now only to rear the fat, gray rabbits that peered at us fearfully from a row of cages. The schoolroom smelled of hay, animal feed, urine, and of wine that was turning to vinegar. On a wooden dais, where in the past a lectern must have stood, some empty tins had been thrown. But nobody had had the temerity to take down the crucifix from the far wall, or to make firewood from the desks that had been pushed up against it. These were more interesting to me than the rabbits. I went to have a closer look. They were long and narrow, each with 4 holes for inkwells, their wood polished by all the hands that had rested there. Inside, with a knife or a nail, those same hands had carved a few letters, initials. The G for Guliamina appeared frequently.
"Do you know who they are?"
"Some of them, yes," Bruno said. "Some of them I don't know, but I've heard of them."
"But when was this?"
"I don't know. The school's always been closed."
I did not get a chance to ask any more questions before we heard Bruno's aunt calling. It was thus that all of our adventures ended. The peremptory command arrived, shouted once, twice, a third time, reaching us wherever we happened to be. Bruno snorted. Then he said goodbye and rushed off. He would drop everything unfinished, a game, a conversation, and I knew that I would not see him again that day. I stayed a little longer in the old school. I examined every desk, read all the initials, and tried to imagine the names of the children. Then, snooping further, I found a more cleanly cut and recently made carving. The grooves left by the knife stood out against the gray wood as if freshly cut. I ran a finger over the G and over the B, and it was impossible to have any doubt as to the identity of their author. And so I made a connection between other things, things that I had seen but not understood in the ruins of the buildings that Bruno would take me to. And I began to understand something about the secret life of that ghost village. July was flying past, meanwhile. The grass, mowed at our arrival, had grown back a foot, and along the mule track the herds passed, headed for the high pastures. I would watch them disappearing up the deep valley, hearing the sound of their hooves and bells as they made their way through the woods, reappearing after a while in the distance above the tree line, like flocks of birds alighted on the mountainside. 2 evenings a week, my mother and I would take the path in the opposite direction towards another village, one that was scarcely more than a handful of houses at the bottom of the valley. It would take us 30 minutes to arrive there on foot, and at the end of the path it seemed as if we had suddenly re-entered the modern world. The lights of a bar illuminated the bridge across the river. Cars could be seen going to and fro on the trunk road, and the music blended with the voices of villagers sitting outside. Down there it was hotter, and the summer was both lively and leisurely, like summers at the seaside. A group of young men was gathered around tables. They were smoking, laughing. Every so often one was picked up by passing friends, and they would drive off together towards the bar higher up the valley. My mother and I, on the other hand, would join the queue for the payphone. We would wait our turn before going together into that cabin exhausted by conversations. My parents would keep it short. Even at home, they were not inclined to small talk. Listening to them was like overhearing old friends who needed few words to understand each other.
"So, mountain man," he would say, "how's it going? Climbed any good peaks lately?"
"Not yet, but I'm in training."
"Good for you. And how's your friend?
He's fine, but he's going up to the Alpeggio soon, so I won't be seeing him anymore. It takes an hour to get there.
Well, an hour away isn't so far. I guess we'll have to go and see him together. What do you think?
I'd like that. When are you coming?
In August, my father would say.
And before signing off, he would add,
Give a kiss to your mother from me. And look after her, do you hear? Don't let her get lonely.
I would promise him that I would, but secretly thought that he was the one feeling alone. I could imagine him in Milan, in the empty apartment with the windows wide open to the noise of traffic. My mother was doing fine. She was happy. We would go back to Grana by the same path through the woods over which darkness had now fallen. She would turn on a torch and direct it at her feet. She had no fear of the night. Her calmness was such that it reassured me, too. We walked, following her boots in that uncertain light, and after a while I would hear her singing in a low voice, as if to herself. If I knew the song, I would join in, also in a low voice. The sounds of traffic, the radios, the laughter of the young people gradually vanished behind us. The air became fresher as we climbed. I knew that I was almost there a little before seeing the lit windows, when the wind carried towards us the smell of chimney smoke.
2. I do not know what changes my father had detected in me that year, but he had already decided that the time had come to take me with him. He came up from Milan one Saturday, breaking into our routine with his battered Alfa, determined not to waste a minute of his short vacation. He had brought a map that he pinned to the wall and a felt-tip pen with which he intended to mark routes taken, as generals do with conquests. The old military backpack, his velvet plus fours, the red jumper worn by the climbers of the Dolomites, this would be his uniform. My mother preferred not to get involved, seeking refuge with her geraniums and her books. Bruno was already away in the alpine pastures, and all I could do was keep going back to our haunts alone, missing him. So I welcomed this new development. I began to learn my father's way of being in the mountains, the nearest thing to an education that I was to get from him. We would leave early in the morning, driving up to the villages at the foot of Monte Rosa. They were more fashionable tourist spots than our own, and with sleep-filled eyes I saw rush past the strings of little villas, the hotels built in an Alpine style in the early 20th century, the ugly condominiums of the 60s, the caravan sites along the river. The whole valley was still in shadow and wet with dew. My father drank a coffee in the first open bar, then flung his rucksack over his shoulder with the seriousness of an Alpine infantryman. The path would start behind a church or after a wooden footbridge, then enter the woods and immediately steepen. Before taking it, I would look up at the sky. Above our heads, the glaciers sparkled, illuminated by the sun. The early morning cold raised the hairs on my arms. On the path, my father would let me walk in front. He would keep a step behind me so that when necessary I could hear what he was saying and hear his breathing. I had rules to follow, few but clear. 1. Establish a pace and keep to it without stopping. 2. No talking. 3. When faced with a fork in the way, always choose the uphill route. He puffed and panted more than I did on account of his smoking and his sedentary office life. But for at least an hour he would not countenance a break, not to get our breath back or to drink or to look at anything. The woods were of no interest in his eyes. It was my mother in our wanderings around Grana who would point out plants and trees and teach me their names as if each one was a person with its own character. But for my father, the woods merely provided access to the mountains. We climbed through them with our heads down, concentrating on the rhythm of our walking, of our legs, lungs, and hearts, in mute, private communion with our own exertions. Underfoot, there were stones worn down over centuries by the passage of animals and men. Sometimes we would pass a wooden cross or a bronze plaque engraved with a name or a shrine with a small Madonna and some flowers, giving to those corners of the wood the somber atmosphere of a cemetery. And then the silence between us assumed a different character, as if this was the only respectful way to pass by them. I would look up only when the trees ended. On the flank of the glacier, the path became less steep, and emerging into the sun, we would come across the last of the high villages. These were abandoned or semi-abandoned places, in even worse condition than Grana, except for the odd isolated stable, a fountain that still worked, a chapel that was still maintained. Above and below the houses, the ground had been flattened and the stones collected in piles, and then ditches had been dug to irrigate and fertilize, and the banks of the river terraced so as to make fields and vegetable gardens. My father would show me these works and speak with admiration of the old mountain people. Those that had arrived from the north of the Alpine region during the Middle Ages were capable of cultivating land where no one else had ventured before. They had special techniques, as well as a special resistance to the cold and to deprivation. Nowadays, he said, no one could survive the winter up there, completely self-sufficient for food and for everything else, as these people had managed to do for centuries. I looked at the crumbling houses and tried hard to imagine their inhabitants. I couldn't even begin to understand how anyone could have chosen such a hard life. When I asked my father, he answered in his usual enigmatic way. It always seemed as if he could not give me a solution, but only a few clues instead, so that I would only arrive at the truth through my own efforts. He said, "They didn't really choose it. If someone comes up this high, it's because down below they won't leave them in peace." "And who is bothering them there, down below?" "Landlords, armies, priests, bosses. It depends." I could tell from the tone of his reply that he wasn't being entirely serious. Now he was bathing his neck with water from the fountain and was already more cheerful than he had been first thing that morning. He shook the water from his head, wrung it from his beard, and looked up above. In the deep valleys that awaited us, there was nothing impeding our view, and sooner or later we would notice someone further up ahead of us on the path. He had an eye as sharp as a hunter's with which to pick out those small red or yellow dots, the color of a rucksack or of an anorak. The more distant they were, the more mocking the tone with which he would ask, pointing to them, "What do you think, Pietro? Shall we catch them?" "Sure," I would answer, wherever they were. Then our climb would be transformed into a pursuit. Our muscles were well warmed up, and we still had energy to burn. We were ascending through the August pastures, past isolated alpeggi, herds of indifferent cows, dogs that came growling around our ankles, and swathes of nettles that stung my bare legs. "Cut across," my father would say, where the path took a slope too gentle for his liking. "Go straight, go up this way." Eventually the incline would steepen, and it was there, on those merciless concluding slopes, that we would catch our prey. Two or three men, about his age and dressed just like him. They confirmed my sense that there was something from another era about this way of going into the mountains, and that it obeyed outmoded codes. Even the manner they adopted when giving way to us had something ceremonious about it. They would step aside to the edge of the path and come to a standstill in order to let us pass. They had no doubt seen us coming, had tried to keep ahead of us, and were not pleased at being caught. "Good day to you," one would say. "The boy sure can run, no?" "He sets the pace," my father would reply. "I just follow." "What I'd give to have legs like his." "That's right, but we did have once." "Oh, sure, decades ago, maybe. Are you going right to the top?"
"If we can make it."
"Good luck," one of them would say. And with that, the exchange was concluded. We would move off in silence, just as we had arrived. Gloating was not allowed, but a little while later, when we were a good distance away, I would feel a hand on my shoulder, just a hand, touching and pressing, and that was all. Perhaps it's true, as my mother maintained, that each of us has a favorite altitude in the mountains, a landscape that resembles us, where we feel best. Hers was no doubt that of the woods at 1,500 meters, that of the spruce and larch, in the shadow of which the blueberries, junipers, and rhododendrons grow, and the roe deer hide. I was more attracted to the kind of mountainscape that comes afterwards, alpine meadows, torrents, wetlands, high-altitude herbs, grazing animals. Higher up again, the vegetation disappears. Snow covers everything until the beginning of summer, and the prevailing color is that of the gray rock, veined with quartz and the yellow of lichen. That was where my father's world began. After 3 hours walking, the meadows and woods would give way to scree, to lakes hidden in glacial basins, to gorges gouged by avalanches, to streams of icy water. The mountain was transformed into a harsher place, inhospitable and pure. Up there he would become happy. He was rejuvenated, perhaps, going back.